This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with longtime civil rights and human rights attorney Martin Garbus about the Danziger Chevron oil case, the most important environmental case of our times.
We talk with longtime civil rights attorney Mike Avery. Mike has written his first crime novel called The Cooperating Witness, and it's based on one of the biggest FBI cases ever litigated. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
What the Chevron Oil Company is doing to environmental and human rights attorney Steve Danziger is a cautionary tale. Danziger has been under house arrest in New York City wearing an ankle bracelet for the last 10 months. His passport has been taken away from him, so he can't travel to see his clients. His family has been bankrupt. He's charged with contempt of court for refusing to turn over confidential material on his computer and his cell phone to Chevron's lawyers. He goes to trial in September, where he's likely to be convicted by a hostile judge. Danziger bravely and skillfully succeeded in obtaining a $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron. This oil giant is the epitome of a ruling class institution with its origins in the Rockefeller family. Chevron bought Texaco, which had polluted an area the size of Rhode Island in the Ecuadorian Amazon region. The indigenous people there are plagued with cancer. Five tribes are affected. It'll cost at least $9 billion to clean up the area. Chevron has refused to pay the judgment and instead has spent over $2 billion in resisting the lawsuit and victimizing Danziger. Top federal judge Lewis A. Kaplan of New York's Southern District has presided over the case in America, where Danziger is seeking to enforce the judgment. Judge Kaplan has shown pronounced favoritism towards Chevron throughout the process of the case. Kaplan made public comments about Chevron's importance to the global economy. He expressed skepticism about the Ecuadorian judgment due to what he called the socialist government of Rafael Correa. And Kaplan himself holds investments in multiple funds with Chevron holdings at the time of his rulings. The Chevron case is the most important environmental case involving corporate responsibility of our times. We speak today with attorney Martin Garbus, who is part of the team representing Danziger. Garbus has a long and distinguished career as a civil rights and First Amendment litigator. Attorney Martin Garbus, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
And congratulations on your victory. We're going to talk about that. When we first interviewed a couple months ago, your client, the human rights attorney, Steve Danziger, had been held in contempt of court by New York federal judge Lewis Kaplan, and he was referred by Kaplan to the disciplinary committee. Why was he charged, and what was the outcome of the disciplinary committee proceedings? You were the attorney there. What happened?
The outcome of the proceeding before John Horan, who had been appointed by the court, by the Bar Association, to conduct the hearing was quite wonderful. He came to the conclusion that Stephen should not be punished in the way that Kaplan wanted him punished. Horan held a hearing onto the entire background of Danziger, as Kaplan had not, and he looked at him in total. And he found that Danziger, which is true, had been a long-time legal defender, had represented people without fees for many, many years, had been involved in Rikers Island representing people, and had written. And the character witnesses that came in on his behalf showed that long before this case came around, he had dedicated a good deal of his life to representing indigent people, poor people, people being deprived of their rights. So what Horan said basically is, in order to punish this man this way, you have to find out, you have to determine that he's a danger to the community. And Horan said you can't find that, that this man is not a danger to the community. So the after after that finding, the Bar Association appealed up to the appellate division, and that's where it sits today. We're waiting to see whether the Bar Association will affirm Horan's findings. If he affirms Horan's findings, then Steve should be able to return to the practice fairly soon. And whatever harm Kaplan and Preska have done to him will be, at least insofar as the Bar Association is concerned, will be alleviated. That, of course, still leaves the criminal charges against him, which we're going to get into. So Horan had a three-day hearing, and at the three-day hearing, you had lawyers who had been involved with Steve Donziger before, as well as litigants in the Ecuadorian case. By and large, these witnesses were uncontradicted. And the decision of Horan, which is on file and is now before the appellate division, is, I think, rather amazing. Generally, when you go through proceedings like this, they're rubber stamps of what someone like Kaplan had found. Horan, with great courage, refused to be that rubber stamp. So it's a kind of, an amazing result, all attributable to the courage of John Horan.
What are the essential facts here, Marty? Donziger had already won a judgment of $9.5 billion on behalf of the indigenous people in Ecuador. And how did he end up in front of Judge Kaplan in New York on a case that had been tried successfully in Ecuador years ago?
Well, Kaplan, ultimately there's an attempt to enforce the judgment in New York because Chevron had taken all of its assets out of Ecuador. And during the course of that proceeding, Kaplan totally ignored whatever Chevron had done, found that the Ecuadorian judgment that Steve had procured had been wrongfully procured. Now, one thing you have to know about the Ecuadorian court system, it's fundamentally controlled by people like Chevron. So the fact that someone like Steve could go into Ecuador and get the kind of result he got is absolutely extraordinary. So this young lawyer, I say young, he's younger than me, which doesn't make him that young, but this lawyer who has dedicated his life to these kinds of issues, after having spent years in Ecuador and having had a miraculous judgment, then finds himself punished in New York.
Andrew Fresh, one of Donziger's attorneys, recently charged in a court filing that Judge Kaplan and Judge Preska, the other federal judge here, charged them with judicial misconduct and abuse of power and urged dismissal of the contempt of court cases. Please give us your thinking on that.
Well, what happened here is jaw-breaking. I've never seen anything like this happen before. After Kaplan held the proceeding dealing with civil contempt, he then wanted to file criminal charges against Donziger. Now, that in itself is extraordinarily rare. But then Kaplan went to the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District, and the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District refused to prosecute. So Kaplan went, as I say, before the U.S. Attorney. He laid out all of his findings. Kaplan had written a 525-page decision. He went to the U.S. Attorney. "This is what I have found," says he. "There's a civil contempt here. There's a criminal contempt here." And the U.S. Attorney said, "No, I'm not going to prosecute." Then what happened is Kaplan reached out. There's a statute which provides, in very, very rare instances, and it's very, very rarely used, that someone like Kaplan has the authority to hire a private lawyer to run a criminal prosecution. I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but I think, let's say, in the last 50 years, that was done once in Manhattan and is rarely done elsewhere. Then, after Kaplan refers the case to this law firm, Seward & Kissel, by the way, a law firm that had previously represented Chevron, and clearly now, if they managed to beat up Steve enough, will become a luminary on behalf of environmental corporations and will be retained by the Chevrons and Exxons. So for them, it's a wonderful, wonderful position. A the U.S. attorney who's appointed, of course, for a criminal prosecution, can't allegedly then go out and get the client. But here, they can do it. And also, this law firm had Chevron as the client before. Then, to close the loop, what Kaplan does is he appoints Judge Preska, who was the former chief judge of the Southern District. Generally, when you appoint judges, they come out of the wheel. It's arbitrary. If I walk into court tomorrow, if you walk into court tomorrow, you will get a judge at random. Here, he selected this particular judge. Now, Preska's law clerk ultimately is a judge that succeeds Kaplan when he steps down. So clearly there's a relationship between Kaplan and Preska. So what you have are three separate elements. You have Kaplan, you have the criminal justice system, headed now by a civil lawyer, and then you have Preska. I've never seen an attempt to trap a lawyer like this.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I was in court the day that Preska sentenced the anarchist hacker, Jeremy Hammond, to 10 years. Young man, put him away for 10 years. And that's what I'm afraid is the kind of justice that's going to be meted out to Danziger.
Preska is a member of the Federalist Society. Of course, has become a little more famous during the Trump era, who, you know, is involved in protecting women of wealth, family of wealth. Seward & Kissel is a very successful law firm representing environmental interests. And this is supposed to be random justice, which, of course, it's not.
What has Chevron done to defend this case? How many lawyers has it used? How much money has it spent? How would you characterize Chevron's defense?
It's fair to say that Chevron has spent many, many, many tens of thousands of dollars. For example, before Horan, where Chevron is not involved, in other words, it's the Bar Association prosecuting Steve, so Chevron has nothing ostensibly to do with the litigation. They had 10 and 11 lawyers sitting in a courtroom for 3 days at the hearing. So you look at this, at the Gibson Dunn law firm, which had originally been representing Chevron in this litigation. So if you look at the cost of that, of 10 lawyers, and they're not young lawyers, they're senior lawyers and middle lawyers, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars just to sit and watch something which they have nothing to do. Now, one of the things that happens in this case is no matter what happens, Chevron puts up massive, massive lawyers and lawsuits. And you and I both know that if someone wants to spend massive amounts of money on lawsuits, you can, come close to breaking somebody. So what happens here is Steve has been dealing with this case for, many years now. There have been many people involved with him. He's had lawyers along the way. He has witnesses. He has Ecuadorians. He has staff. If you get involved with Steve, I'm not particularly worried about it, but if you get involved with Steve, you're going to be attacked. And, for example, there's a lawyer named Aaron Page who has been devoted to Steve for many, many years. He's under attack. As you and I know from the law business, that if you have a piece of paper that's totally honest and innocuous, and if you want to spend, as Chevron will do it, tens of thousands of dollars to harass people, they can do it. They have an unlimited budget. So that, in a way, they're trying to frighten off people, lawyers, but also people who want to help him fund the case. I mean, one of the difficulties here is Steve has been involved in the case now for many years. They have stopped his practice. He has no way of making any funds at all. And there are also people who contribute to the case. Anybody who contributes in large sums, not small sums, can have problems. We're trying to raise money now to help Steve get through this. And we, you know, have ways of protecting those people. But in the past, people who were involved with Steve, and you're talking about a very long litigation, people who were involved with Steve have all been personally harassed. Mr. Frisch made certain arguments, which you've pointed out, namely, that there's corruption in the legal system. Mr. Frisch is a fine lawyer who has an extraordinary reputation in the criminal courts. Is there a possibility that ultimately there'll be some kind of proceeding against him? Absolutely. I mean, the allegations that he made in court, namely about judicial corruption with respect to Kaplan and Preska, is the kind of thing that can get him into trouble. Steve has another dedicated lawyer, Richard Friedman. Are these lawyers sure that they're going to walk away from this case or just have it turn into an ordinary representation? The answer is no. So this is really, you know, Michael, you and I have been through a lot of cases and a lot of political situations. I've represented, as you know, Nazis, fascists, Ellsberg, lots of different people, some good, some saints, some not saints. I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen the kinds of this whole question of a private judge being a private party being appointed to prosecute a case. I mean, what could be more offensive than to have Chevron's lawyers, funded people who previously represented Chevron and want to represent Chevron tomorrow? So the Seward and Kissel, if they crush Steve and as they defend this case, will gain a reputation as having been able to fend off people like Steve or people who want to prosecute companies, go after companies like Enron and Chevron that commit the ghastly things. For example, it was done in Ecuador in this particular case. This is an extraordinary case. It goes far beyond Danziger. You know, Michael, you and I have been involved 30, 40 years. I've never seen anything like it. I've been in the South. I've been with Chavez. And as I said, I've represented good people and bad people. But I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, Marty Garbus, I've never seen anything like it either. It's really extraordinary. Some people are saying this is the most important environmental case of our times, and they're up against the epitome of a ruling class operation. Chevron came out of Standard Oil. That was the Rockefeller family. They've got, I think, $284 billion in assets, and they're willing to spend them. But let's talk about what kind of support Steve Danziger is getting. Today, I know that the Chevron Corporation is having its annual board meeting, and several people are there to protest the fact that they haven't done a thing to clean up their damage in Ecuador. Talk about that, and more broadly, what kind of support the legal community is coming up with for Steve Danziger.
Well, Steve has gotten extraordinary support, not just from, let's say, the left of the legal community, but has gotten extraordinary support from all aspects of the legal community, right, left, and center. I mean, there's a recognition. What's happening today is interesting. This happens to be, in this particular day, there's something called the Global Living Room. Okay, Steve is today talking before the Global Living Room. 29 Nobel Prize winners have come out in support of Steve. I have been involved in a lot of organizational law politics. I've never seen such an outpouring. Amnesty International has come out on his behalf, speaking today and having previously issued statements, when 29, as I said, Nobel Prize winners. That's remarkable. Alec Baldwin, a lot of theatrical people, political people, have come out speaking on his behalf. I don't know any lawyer. You know, you and I lived through some hard times when we saw lawyers, Michael, ostracized, and we saw defense committees for various lawyers. I've never seen a lawyer get the breadth of support that Steve has, because I think we all recognize the importance of environmental issues. We recognize that as COVID is here, environmental issues are here also. And we all recognize that, however, COVID is botched up in its defense, that the amount of attention that Trump and his people pay to environmental issues is awful. We all understand how they're rolling it back. I think that, you know, there's a great deal of very important litigation going on now in the country, an extraordinary amount of Trump litigation. I think this is the most important single case in the world right now, because either the environmental companies like Chevron and Enron can break somebody like Steve, can invalidate an Ecuadorian judgment which went through all the Ecuadorian courts. And if you were to look at those proceedings, there was a film made of the case up to a point called Crude by Joe Bellinger. It's about 10 years ago. But he takes he follows the case through the Ecuadorian courts, and that film shows you the devastation that the oil companies wrecked on Ecuador. Starvation, deaths. It's ghastly. And the fact that they can get away with it, with the backing of a federal judge, this crazy thing that allows him to appoint a civil person involved in making money through the oil companies to go after Steve, and then to handpick the judge, someone he has known for years, with whom he's had a very close relationship, is stunning. So Horan's decision is the first decision that is squarely in Steve's favor. It's written by a man who has nothing to do with the oil companies and had never met Steve or knew nothing about him until this proceeding started. And he wrote a very dignified, intelligent decision, which, as I say right now, is before the appellate division. Now, it would be nice to believe that the appellate division is free of all rancor and is free of all bias, but we know that's not so. So we'll have to see.
In 2013, Chevron sold its assets in Ecuador. They fled the country, and they threatened human rights lawyers and their indigenous clients with, quote, a lifetime of litigation. Is that happening now? I mean, how is this judgment ever going to get enforced? What are the next steps here?
Well, the next steps are to go somewhere else. I think that the New York litigation it will go on for too long. I think it'll go on long after Steve's death. The only time you're going to get any relief in this case is if you can go to another country. And right now, there are attempts to enforce the litigation in Canada. Extraordinary lawyers have been retained. The Canadian legal system, we don't have a Kaplan, we don't have a Preska, and we don't have a law firm there that's in the environmental business on behalf of oil companies. And it may be that we can get a different judgment there. But the fact that a Southern District judge has determined that the judgment should not be enforced is a problem. You have to get past that. So that's another hurdle in the fight, and it makes the fight much, much longer.
Marty, we've only got time for one more question, and that's this. How can our listener to support Steve Donziger? What would you suggest they do? Is there a website they can go to? Is there a defense committee?
Yes, there's a defense committee called DonzigerDefense.com. This is going to be a long, long fight. I ask anybody who hears this to help. As I said, I think it's one of the most important cases in the world, and I think Donziger is a fine, decent human being that they're attempting to brutalize.
Marty Garbus, thank you so much for being a guest on Law and Disorder. You've been on the right side in the courts now for 6 decades, and you're certainly on the right side of this one. You take care of yourself, and let's check in later on to talk about how this case evolves. Be well, Marty Garbus. Bye-bye, and thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. As summer begins in the time of COVID-19, many people are returning to or discovering the age-old pleasure of reading. With that in mind, Law and Disorder is delighted to recommend our first thriller novel. One of our longtime legal experts, civil rights attorney Mike Avery, has written The Cooperating Witness. While Mike has been writing for decades, this is his first piece of nonfiction. As prestigious as are his other titles, one on the Federalist Society, others on legal topics such as the laws of evidence in Massachusetts, The Cooperating Witness is sure to have great appeal to our listeners. The book starts by introducing readers to Susan Sorella, a law student at Suffolk Law School where Mike used to teach. From the start, we learn that Susan is no ordinary student. As she waits on tables at her father's restaurant in Boston's North End, the head of the local mob pays her a surprise visit. He is just one of many shady characters Susan encounters on her quest to help a jaded defense attorney save an innocent man charged with killing the mob's accountant. Joining us to talk about his debut crime novel is Mike Avery. As a civil rights attorney, Mike spent over 4 decades defending victims of police abuse and racial and sexual discrimination. He has served as the president of the National Lawyers Guild and the National Police Accountability Project. He co-authored The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals, which we've covered on Law and Disorder. Mike, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Mike, congratulations on your wonderful new book, The Cooperating Witness. What inspired the storyline?
Well, as far as the idea goes of the FBI framing innocent men for murder, the novel is based loosely on the last case I tried as a lawyer. In the 1960s, the FBI framed 4 innocent men for a murder that was actually committed by an FBI informant. That informant, Jimmy Flemmy, was the younger brother of Stephen Flemmy, who was also an FBI informant, and Stephen became the partner of the infamous Whitey Bulger. The FBI was in a partnership with mobsters, in fact with killers, for over 30 years. My client, Peter Lamoni, spent 33 years in prison for a murder of which he was completely innocent.
Michael, why did it take 3 decades for this case to come out into the open?
Well, the FBI never wanted the truth to come out about this frame-up in the 1960s because it would have led ultimately to the undoing of their relationship with Stephen Flemmy and Whitey Bulger. They were maintaining their relationship with these gangsters in order to prosecute their war against Italian organized crime.
And when you were litigating this case, you are obviously an experienced police misconduct attorney, but did you learn anything that surprised you?
You know, I spent my entire professional career occupied with issues of law enforcement misconduct. But what the FBI did in Boston was the most corrupt and unprincipled government crime I ever saw. And the fact of the matter is it was sanctioned by J. Edgar Hoover and top officials of the FBI in Washington. Their belief was that the end justifies the means, and they were willing to do literally anything, including being complicit in murders to go after Italian organized crime.
And Michael, are the men who served unjust prison terms still alive today?
Only one of them is still alive. 2 of them died in prison. One got out after 30 years, and my client, Peter Lamoni, got out after 33 years. He went to prison when he was 33 and got out when he was 66, and he has subsequently passed away. So only one of these men is still alive.
How closely does the narrative in your new book, The Cooperating Witness, hew to the realities of this specific case?
The novel goes off in a different direction from reality. The focus of the novel is Susan Sorella, this young student at Suffolk Law School, and the struggle she has with her boss, the burned-out lawyer Bobby Coughlin, as they work to establish the innocence of Nicky Marino, their client. So the novel is really more about this young woman struggling to make her way in the criminal justice world of Boston. And the backdrop is sort of the FBI conspiracy to frame innocent people.
Michael, how did you come up with the idea of a law student, essentially one of the lead characters? Is Susan Sorella based on a real person?
She's not based on a real person, but I have to say that the qualities she has were probably present in a lot of the very best students that I taught. You know, when I started the book, I thought the lead character was going to be Bobby Coughlin. He was a lawyer who had suffered a terrible setback early in his career. It left him afraid to fight for his clients. He was just sort of shuffling through life, taking court appointments to represent indigent clients and pleading them guilty. You know, there are lawyers like that in every town. A judge in Washington once called them walking violations of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Well, Susan was originally just going to be Bobby's assistant, but as I wrote, she took over more and more work on their case and eventually took over the book. I learned that fictional characters really can develop a life of their own. She has a strong personality, and I found myself waking up in the morning asking, what is Susan going to do today?
Factoring into your characters, obviously, are members of organized crime. How much did you learn during your court case, or did you have to conduct additional research to bring life to these characters?
Well, I've been a lawyer for 50 years now. And the more experience I got, the more I came to realize that things are seldom black and white. The gray area just kept getting larger and larger. And when you write fiction, it's not interesting for the readers to write about people who are either all good or all bad. So I kind of became fascinated with the idea of developing Frank Romano, the mob boss, as somebody who was ruthless, but also somebody who was intelligent and sensitive and caring when it came to Susan and her father. Along the same lines, when Romano assigns a couple of his men, heavy guys, to protect Susan, she develops a friendly relationship with him, chatting about Italian cooking and the Boston Red Sox. So I had known a number of characters over the course of my career, and a lot of them, you know, had actually done the things they were accused of doing. But on another level, they weren't such bad people. So I guess I learned from that and just kind of developed a feeling for these guys in the book. By the way, Susan's not perfect either. She's impetuous, and that created a lot of problems for her.
Mike, you've written so many legal treaties and related pieces over your career. When did you decide you wanted to turn to fiction, and how did that transpire?
You know, I retired from teaching at Suffolk Law School when I was 70 years old. And I had written, as you mentioned, some books about law and some books about politics. And I didn't feel that they were as successful as I had wanted them to be. And so I decided to go back to school to learn a little bit more about writing nonfiction. And I enrolled at Bennington College in Vermont, which had a low residence Master of Fine Arts program. And I started attending Bennington to learn about writing nonfiction. But they let you switch one semester to a different genre. So just for fun, I switched to fiction, and I just fell in love with it. I realized first that I knew nothing about it, and so there was a great deal to learn. But I love the idea that you could just make things up, and you know, you didn't have to footnote everything the way you do when you're writing legal work, and you could just kind of have fun, grab the wind and sail away. So I just got hooked on it.
I'm curious, did you have to storyboard this book? Did you know how it was going to end?
You know, I think it's a good idea to storyboard a book, and I think it's a good idea to know the arc of the story before you begin, but I didn't know that when I was writing this book. So I just started writing, and one thing led to the next, and about halfway through, I realized I had to figure out an ending, and that took a while, but it actually just kind of developed, you know, from day to day on its own.
You know, Mike, I want to add that I read many books in this genre, and I watch a lot of TV related to police procedurals. The thing that I love about your book, aside from the story arc, is your writing is quite beautiful. It's not typical short sentences, page turner after another, although it does have that element to it, but you really enjoy reading the prose. And I think that's what makes your book so special. It has a great plot, but it's also well written.
Thank you very much. I mean, I read mysteries my whole life. And when it came time to write one, I didn't want to write a book that was just one car chase, so to speak, after another. And I really wanted to spend more time on the characters. My teacher at Bennington encouraged me to read Richard Price's books, who's a brilliant writer. And I would never pretend to be able to write like Richard Price, but I saw how he would get so deeply into his characters and their internal monologues. And I kind of became fascinated with that approach.
Michael, we're intentionally trying not to give too much away about this because I'm hoping that our listeners are going to run out and buy a copy to have. But we would love to hear you read a section or two from the book. Could you do that for us?
Sure. I can read you a scene where Susan meets with her boss, Bobby Coughlin, to tell him about what the head of the mob in Boston, Frank Romano, had told her when he came to see her in her father's restaurant. And the information from Romano contradicts the prosecution's theory of the murder, which was that Romano's friend Danny Costa had ordered the murder of their accountant, Tony Francini, because he was stealing with Romano. So in this scene, Susan has gotten some information from Romano, and now she's going to tell Coughlin about it. Susan entered Coughlin's private office. He was leaning back in his chair, reading with his foot propped against the file drawer. He looked up. "I've been appointed to represent Nicky Marino. Do you know who he is?" he asked without so much as a greeting. "One of the clients charged with the Francini murder," she said. "How did you land this case?" "It's not anything I wanted. Judge Morgan put me on it." Susan sat down. "Should be a lot of publicity." "Yeah, but who needs it? The vultures in the media are going to be second-guessing my every move." "It so happens I've got some information about that case," she said. "How would you know anything about it?" "Somebody who knew I was working for you came to see me." Susan crossed her legs, and Coughlin's eyes darted from her face to the hem of her skirt as it rode up above her knee. Good God. It didn't take much, and it never stopped. She shifted slightly in her chair and let the skirt ride up a couple more inches just to torment him. She felt a little cheap, but messing with her boss's head gave her some revenge for all the boring jobs he'd given her. He tore his glance away from her legs. "Someone came to see you." "Who?" "Frank Romano." "What?" He shot forward in his chair, and his foot kicked the file drawer closed with a loud bang. "Romano," she said. "You're kidding me." "No. He knows my father, and he came to the restaurant to talk to me. Why didn't he just come?" "Wait. What do you mean he knows your father?" She wasn't sure how to answer that. She didn't want to say anything that would imply that her father was connected. "I think he knows him through the restaurant. Most of the people in the North End have eaten there." Maybe Coughlin would let that slide. "I don't get why Romano would talk to you instead of me," he said. "Ah, that was his main concern, of course." Well, she wasn't about to speculate on that subject. She'd try to keep him focused on the story itself. He said that he and Danny Costa didn't have anything to do with Francini's murder. Big surprise, Coughlin said. She uncrossed her legs and sat forward. There's more. Francini hadn't been taking money. Romano had no problem with him. Costa wasn't involved. And it's likely that Brady is lying about Nicky Marino. What do you expect him to say? Coughlin said. Of course, he denies it. It was obvious that Coughlin was offended that Romano had come to her. These male ego-driven power plays were exhausting. So much extra work. The interruptions, the put-downs, the mansplaining. She shouldn't have to sell Romano's information. Any halfway intelligent lawyer would realize it was worth investigating. If someone accused a man like Frank Romano of murder, she said, of course he'd deny it, even if he was guilty. But I hadn't accused him of anything. He sought me out. He wanted me to give you some very specific information that Francini was not stealing from him. So what? Coughlin said. Nobody can prove whether he was or not. Suppose the DA subpoenaed Romano's books. They were kept by Francini. They wouldn't show much. And I don't suppose he offered to testify that Francini wasn't stealing. That's true, Susan said. He admitted there was no point in his coming to court with this. This doesn't really amount to anything. Certainly nothing we can use. Coughlin shook his finger at her. In the future, you are to leave interviews with potential witnesses up to me. Isn't the prosecution going to claim that the motive for the murder was that Francini was stealing from Romano, she said? Romano contradicts that, and, as I said, that's nothing that can be proved one way or the other, Coughlin said. We have to be realistic and look at the evidence. I saw the prosecutor, Tom Flanagan, this morning, and he has a cooperating witness. One of the killers, Brady, has flipped and given up the whole story. Susan grimaced. If Romano had no motive to kill Francini, maybe they should be looking for someone who did have a motive. That was certainly worth looking into. Why couldn't Coughlin see that? He wasn't taking her seriously. He probably thought of her as nothing more than a pretty girl who was still a student. He didn't know anything about her. When she applied for the job, he hadn't even requested her transcript.
I love that scene, Michael. There's so much going on, a stream of consciousness, conversation, peeks into each of their characters. Did conversation come naturally to you?
It's about the only thing about writing that did come naturally to me. For some reason, I found it easy to write dialogue. I had a lot more trouble with other aspects of writing, but maybe because, you know, I've interviewed so many witnesses or questioned so many people in court. I don't know. Somehow the dialogue just seemed to come easier than other things.
Now, when you were working on the Lamona case, and that took several years, didn't it?
Oh, yes. We worked on that for 8 years or so.
8 years. Did you have one or more interns to help you on that?
Well, I was part of a large team. There were 10 lawyers working on the case. And I had asked a friend of mine, Julianne Bolero, to work on it. And she was part of a law firm. Coincidentally, Julianne's father, Joe Bolero, had been one of the defense lawyers in the original trial when these men got convicted, and he had never had access to the information that we had by the time we were bringing our case against the government. But there was a large team of people working on this case. There were tens of thousands of documents that had to be examined and 30 years of history to explore. So it was a much bigger job than one lawyer could ever hope to do.
I remember one of the first crime novels I read was an Ed McBain, one of his precinct books. And one of the things that stood out to me was how he always mentioned what he was eating. He liked to have a wet sandwich that he ate standing up. And I've got to say, your book really brings to life Boston's Italian North End and the food. Did you, was that an intentional part of depicting the Italian culture and the locality of Boston?
Yes, it was. Susan Sorella's father, Lorenzo, has a restaurant on Hanover Street in Boston. Now, this is entirely fictional, of course. And he's a chef, and she loves cooking herself, and I like to cook. I like to cook a lot, and I particularly like to cook Italian food. So I thought it would be interesting to mix food into the story in a way to lend a little flavor to that side of it. In fact, there's a scene later in the book when Bobby Coughlin makes a chicken marsala for dinner, and if you read the scene, you know how to make chicken marsala. You can learn how to do it from the book.
Michael, are you working on your next novel, and will we see more of Susan Sorella?
Yes. She graduates, passes the bar. She becomes a criminal defense lawyer. Frank Romano will return as well, and he's going to help Susan defend a man who's accused of murdering a Major League Baseball umpire.
Okay, that combines another one of your loves, I know, for the Red Sox.
Yes, and Susan loves the Red Sox, too. She's an avid baseball fan.
Surprise! I also want to touch on the issue of romance. Now, again, not wanting to give anything away, in the first Susan Sorella novels, there's a hint of an attraction between another character. Are we going to see that develop?
I don't think I want to give that away either, but Susan does get attracted to one of the lawyers on the case. They take some steps toward getting together, but she's shy about it and cautious because of some experiences she's had in her background.
Now, Michael, what's the time frame for novel number two?
Well, it's a few years after novel number one. She's graduated, she's passed the bar, she's a few years into her career, and as the book starts, she's trying her first felony case in the Boston Superior Court.
But time frame for your writing it?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
You know, I hope to finish it by the end of the summer. And then, of course, it takes a very long time after you finish a book before it actually, hits the streets. I never have understood exactly why it takes so long, but it does. So I'm not sure when, readers will have it available. Hopefully next year, but we'll have to see how it goes.
Do you anticipate drawing on some of your prior cases to inform future story arcs?
I'd like to. I'd like to keep going with Susan Sorella. My hope will be that, she'll become the kind of character that people like to read about in book after book if I can provide that. I suppose that remains to be seen. But over the course of my career, I had many interesting cases. I felt so privileged and fortunate to be a trial lawyer and to get involved in people's lives and with their problems and with their challenges. And it really gave me a window onto the world that I otherwise would never have had. I've spoken with you before, for example, about my Armenian terrorism case, which was one of my favorites over the course of my career, and it gave me a whole chance to learn about Armenia and the history of Armenia. As a lawyer, you get a chance to see and learn things that most people don't get.
Michael, in our last couple of minutes, can you tell us what it was like to write from a female voice?
Well, that was very difficult, and whether I did a good job or not is something that the readers will have to decide. But I got a lot of help from the strong women that I know in my life, including Jill, the woman I live with. And in particular, I have to thank my two daughters, who are young, very independent, smart, and feminists. from time to time, I would ask them to read a section of the book and tell me whether I was off base. To the extent I got things right, I have to give them credit, but I'm afraid that to the extent I made mistakes, I'll have to take the blame.
I know you were close with the Limone family. Have they read the book yet?
Well, I just actually sent it to them last week, so I'm hoping that they're reading it now. I was very close with the family, and I admired my client, Peter Limone, a great deal. He spent 33 years in prison for something he didn't do, and yet he was philosophical about it and not resentful and still had a very positive attitude toward life. I admired them about him enormously.
What a graceful man he was. Mike Avery, again, congratulations on a riveting and beautifully written book. The book is The Cooperating Witness. Listeners, I hope we'll run out and get a copy. And Mike, do you have a website, or how can listeners learn or read more about you?
I have a website, michaelavery.work. There's a button on there that will connect them to Amazon where they can order the book.
Best of luck on your next novel. We can't wait to read it. And thank you again for being on Law and Disorder.
Heidi, thank you very much for the opportunity.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.